In time, it will weaken the English position, as England in the world's eyes will loom as a bully tormenting a helpless old lady. Great Britain is losing an excellent fight. Non-resistance is hard to beat. He had some misgivings about India's future under self-rule, as to whether those people will remain or whether the prayers and supplications of others will be heeded depends on individuals. In India, the cradle of knowledge is not applied, except within self. What is the sin of India? Self, and leaving the ish off. Just self. Not until the total obliteration of India's pernicious caste system, not only in law, but in the hearts of man, did he see a free India basking in the light of freedom. He was concerned, above all, with his own country. America the beautiful, rugged, ambitious, yet generous and warm-hearted. A country often divided by race and religion, yet caring for the homeless, the underdog, the aged, and the infirm. He would close his eyes and question his universal intelligence. Is America fulfilling its destiny? Is it filling its place as a nation? What, my children, have ye done with the knowledge that ye have respecting the relationships of thy Creator to thy fellow man? And hast thou made known that ye know of his ways, God's ways, among thy fellows? Yea, here and there, as you have seen, America has become the fusion of many different cultures, which helps, as it were, to leaven the whole. Elsewhere, he stressed that brotherhood was necessary for the United States to continue as the land of the free and the home of the brave. And then he got into the millennium. And here, there, as given, his messenger shall appear, finding those that make the path straight. Warning repeatedly of riots in the streets, he stressed they could lead to chaos unless there was a love of country by the rioters and the power brokers. For all had the same responsibility to see the country prosper with, as a great leader said, government of the people, by the people, for the people. He saw problems with big labor getting as big or bigger than big capital, strutting about, showing its muscles. The author was tuning in on all this when a stormy United Parcel Service strike broke out. He wondered whether Casey's antenna had reached out and scanned what he was putting on paper. The strike dragged on and affected millions of people. Jeff Stern listened to a brace of exchanges between the company and its striking union, then went on to what Casey had to say about peace between labor and capital. While needed demands are being made by labor and capital, there may be worked out that which can bring better relationships. Else there will come such divisions as to cause a general uproar and the need for legislation to control same. So long as there is not a united labor, added America's greatest psychic, there may be dealings with capital. The greater troubles are those that might arise from a united labor against capital. As a one-time unionist, the newspaper guild, Jeff Stern blinked, then remembered the three great newspapers killed by a printer's strike. It was a sad day for America, and newspaper people everywhere. Chapter 6, The Death Ray. The sleeping prophet awakened from a deep trance one day to learn that he had predicted that a death ray, such as he had visualized in fabled Atlantis, would be produced in this country in 25 years. Casey had already left this earth plane when the scientists at a University of California, Berkeley laboratory came up with a supercosmic ray bringing in the pre-millennial age. It was called the death ray, forecast in 1933, conceived in 1958. To be activated, a laser-like proton beam had to come together with a stream of antineutrons to develop the necessary antiprotons to produce a tremendous energy. There was no evidence the resulting beam had been applied in our society. Obviously, if used and effective, there would have been little to show for it. The announcement of the ray was followed by an academic blackout a death ray couldn't pierce. Other scientists saw the possibilities of combining antineurons and antiprotons, whatever they are, to convert matter into energy, disposing of the problem, whether a dinosaur or a creaky building. But by this time, the atomic bomb had displaced the death ray as a 20th century horror story. The Casey prediction came out of a virtual blackout. It had developed from a question by the seer's son, Hugh Lynn Casey, who was investigating stories of a great Earth Congress to map plans for the destruction of the 80-ton dinosaurs that once roamed the planet. Casey saw clearly that the people of this primitive period had no weapons available to handle the monsters that were overrunning the land and foraging to save themselves from extinction. The answer, he saw, was in prayer to the Almighty to give them the insight and power to overcome this menace they couldn't fight with the raw iron and stones that were their only weapons. Looking back thousands of years, he told his son, in the period when this became necessary, there was the consciousness raised in the minds of the groups in various portions of the earth, much in the manner as would be illustrated by an all-world broadcast in the present day of a menace in any one particular point or in many particular points. And the gathering of those that heeded, as would be the scientific minds of the present day, in devising ways and means of doing away with that particular kind or class of menace. As to the manner in which these gathered, it was very much as if it would be the Zeppelin, an ill-fated German dirigible, were to gather those that were to counsel and to cooperate in that effort. And this was in that particular plane or sphere, in a land which has long since lost its identity. And so these men of a simple nature went deep within themselves and prayed to the Spirit in the heavens, the Creator, and the Son they worshipped Him by, for the help they could find nowhere else. For prayer was the only weapon they had in so unequal a struggle, and the sun, with its light and heat, was their avenue to the Lord, as it was to so many of the natives Columbus found when he discovered America. How was it to be done? In a very ingenious way, obviously with heavenly help, for in no other way could it have been achieved. Just as Casey said again and again that with the Lord man can achieve anything, and without him there are only continuing upheavals of the earth and endless contention and wars reflected in the eruptions within the bowels of the earth. It was the Lord, said Casey, who showed them how to use the sun to make the cosmic rays that kept his favorite creatures, best known to himself, from being wiped out by the roving bands of 80-ton monsters. Their prayers were heeded, as Casey describes. Man has ever, even as then, when in distress, either mental, physical, or spiritual, sought to know his connection with the divine force that brought the worlds into being. As these are sought, so does the promise hold true that giveth man from the beginning. Will ye be my children, I will be thy God. Ye turn your face from me, my face is turned from thee. And those things you have builded in thine own endeavor to make manifest thine own powers, bring those certain destructions in the lives of individuals in the present, even as in those first experiences with the use of those powers that are so taboo by the worldly wise, that are looked upon as old men's tales and women's fables. Yet, in the strength of such forces, do worlds come into being. Casey was again alluding to the power of prayer, which such scientists as Einstein and Newton understood so well. Knowing enough to know that the immensity of a world that transcended time and space could only have been born of a divine force that interceded only when man seemed on the verge of destroying himself. And that force, as Casey said, was exemplified by what the psychic force did mean, has meant, and does mean in the world today. With this force, Casey said, helped by the Lord, primitive man was able to reach a higher consciousness where he employed crystals to capture the explosive power of the sun and direct the rays at various stations at the hordes of trumpeting monsters bent on taking over the earth. Even greater monsters, Casey said in 1936, would soon begin their war against the civilized world, but they would be two-legged monsters, with the promise again given by the Lord that they would be destroyed in turn. In other ages, some prehistoric humans invading the fabled continent of Atlantis, traveling through space, were able to destroy that portion of the continent over which the Sargasso Sea presently floats. These people of Atlantis, according to Casey, had lost the support of the Creator with their licentious and greedy lives, their lust for power, their disregard of the Almighty who had advanced them in their status. It was, said Casey, the first atomic war. The individuals, the invaders, being able to raise the powers from the sun itself to the ray that makes for the disintegration of the atom, brought about the destruction in that portion of the land now presented, or called, the Sargasso Sea. With the subsequent destruction in Atlantis, the secret of manipulating the sun in the disintegration of the atom was lost. In this falling back on a power of self, some other self, presumed to be of greater power than God himself, was destroyed. The closest thing to a death ray prior to its discovery in a California laboratory resulted from a Columbia University professor's research into the increase in cosmic ray energy, accounting in part for global warming. Professor Bruce Heason, a true scientist, didn't delve into the harnessing of such energies for weapons of mass destruction, some of which has been carried on by others and has now entered the military mainstream, where it is talked about in whispers behind locked doors. Something akin to the Casey death ray was described as a particle beam weapon, which sends energy into the atomic structure of the target, causing the electrons to shift about. By releasing more energy than the inanimate target can absorb, this causes the target's molecules to come apart in a thermal explosion. This is another high-frequency energy weapon known among the Carnuscienti or insiders as the Star Wars technology. Some wondered whether this was similar to the killer weapon Casey said was employed with the help of sun-magnetized crystals to demolish the dinosaurs that once romped around Atlantis. In Heason's research, he cited mass extinctions resulting from a shift in the magnetic field, including the vulnerable ozone hole, through which the ultraviolet rays of the sun, described as a shimmering ball of atomic power, bombarded the unwitting Earth people. Heason described his findings at a congress of more than 1,000 scientists, sponsored by UNESCO and the Soviet government, in a New Age display of international amiability, such as Casey had foreseen. Heason explained that when the Earth's magnetic field reverses, there is a period, as it reverses poles, when the electromagnetic field around the Earth appears. That last reversal of the magnetic field was 700,000 years ago. At the present time, the magnetic field is decreasing, subjecting the Earth to the cosmic bombardment Casey warned about. It would take a Casey to understand how the scientists could bandy all these millenniums around as if they were so many minutes. Some of the scientists were baffled as well, with the press staggered more by the grand scope of the heavens than a Casey prediction of Christ's return for his birthday. The analysis of rock cores extracted from the floors of the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans provided proof of the magnetic reversals, said the head of Columbia's Lamont Geological Observatory. But with science so frequently falling back on assumptions dealing with phenomena occurring a million years ago and a million miles away, it was easily understood why few but Casey understood the reversal of the Earth's magnetic field. That was the way the Creator planned it. It was an orderly process that man had more to do with than he thought. And, as Casey elaborated, man has ever, even then, when in distress, sought to know his association, his connection, with the divine forces that brought the worlds into being. As these are sought, so does the promise hold true, given from the beginning. Will ye be my children? I will be thy God. Ye turn your face from me, my face is turned from thee, and those things you have builded in thine own endeavor to make manifest thine own powers bring those certain destruction in the lives of individuals in the present, even as in those first experiences with the use of those powers that are so taboo with the worldly wise, that are looked upon as old man's tales and woman's fables. Yet in the strength of such forces do worlds come into being. The scientists didn't follow Casey any more than he followed them. But a handful of scientists, including Professor Heason, believed that excessive bombardment of cosmic rays passing through gaping holes in the magnetic field's ozone layer were capable of causing genetic mutations leading to a new species of life. Evoking such heavy blasts of cosmic rays, they triggered the extinction of some species, including the rampaging dinosaurs. Besides a death ray, Casey foresaw all kinds of low-level light beams, lasers, which could be used in medicine and warfare. Before the millennium, as recently as 1997, the U.S. Air Force was testing the striking power of beams of light from lasers at moving targets, primarily orbiting satellites in space, which Casey described. The 6-foot-wide beam of light from the laser was able to track the satellite and illuminate it. A nice way of saying it destroyed its target. The tests were held at the Air Force base in White Sands, New Mexico, amid gossip that the Defense Department's heavy-duty laser, prophetically named the Miracle, would be a killer ray. The Defense Department was quick to dispel reports of a destroyer out of Mars or Atlantis, or a Casey reading. The tests were being held, officials said, to check the vulnerability of our satellites to laser strikes, deliberate or inadvertent, not as offensive weapons against any other power. Casey foreshadowed light beams, later used in healing. He spoke of radionics, used in color therapy, and an etheronic analyzer, checking any disharmony in the human body. Radionics, originally mentioned by Casey, was developed by a San Francisco physician. He theorized that disease could be diagnosed by evaluating radiation from the human body. Support for radionics, and Casey, came from Professor William Tiller, chairman of material science at Stanford University. He saw promise in color therapy. There is Soviet work going on at this moment in which they are shining laser beams at acupuncture points, and depending on the wavelengths they use, they are producing healing modalities. They're getting strong effects of recuperation in people for a whole variety of conditions, but it depends on the color combinations they use. In this particular case, laser light. Things are moving so fast in the premillennial period, we often take change for granted. Ours is the age of computer communication, satellite programming, fiber optics, instant access cable. Our VCRs are voice programmable. Our grocery checkout lines scan prices with lasers, and a wafer-thin computer disk contains the 14,000 Edgar Casey readings. Whether it's medicine, technology, ecology, or biology, the world is very different from what it was 15 or 20 years ago, let alone 6 or 7 decades ago, when Casey was predicting all these things and more. Long before television was no more than a wink in the inventor's eye, Casey saw it clearly on the screen of his mind. He saw it first in the advanced technology of Atlantis, where there was the storage, as it were, of the motivative forces in nature from the great crystals that so condensed the lights, the forms, the activities, as to guide not only the ship upon the bosom of the sea, but in the air. And many of those now known conveniences for man, as in the transmission of the body and of the voice, as in the recording of those activities in what is soon to become a practical thing in so creating the vibrations as to make for television. He was asked, how long will be the period of popular development? In the next 15 years. He had years before predicted the popularity of another magic development, a radio without wires of any sort. How, he asked, will the television affect the radio? He saw a lag in television for the wrong reasons. Dependent upon how easily those who have investments of such an extent are willing to allow television to take its place, mainly the radio interests, fearful television would supplant radio. Casey saw both living together as they had before. The first radio, like the first television set, he said, was invented in Atlantis and placed for the first time in North America, in Yucatan, brought to this continent by the Atlanteans, establishing the temple through which there was hoped to be the appearance again of the children of the Law of One, new Atlantean migrants, as they listened to the oracles that came through the stones, the crystals, that were prepared for communications in what ye know as radio. This gave the author a bit of a start. The first radio he had owned as a boy was called a crystal set. In 1936, Casey was asked what investments were best for the next few years. Those that have to do with communications when considered for years. Which predictions would have enriched those who used this advice to invest in the high-tech stocks featured in the bullish stock markets of the 1990s, including the industries tied in with computers and the Internet? Again, he stressed, the industrials having to do with communications of all natures for long term. He showed more restraint, though equal foresight, when 3 years before the outbreak of World War II in Europe, he put on his immediate buy list. Those stocks that are of allied industrials that deal with preparation of war materials for the next few months. He had a prolonged interest in the communications industry, having said that as long as people and nations kept their communication lines open, peace would reign among diverse peoples and nations. In the study, in the preparation for the mental and material advancement in communications, he said as early as 1934, especially as to those relationships that we find should be as fact in a few years, the united activity of radio and the telegraph lines. This is indicated by the field of activity through the radiograms from the communication in the distant portions, not only from vessels at sea, but land communications handled in pretty much the same manner. The merging of the communication systems, predicted by Casey, resulted in the international telecommunication systems, noted by a popular magazine 30 years later under the headline, From Telepathy to Space Communications in 100 Years. Casey foresaw international broadcasts by television and then went on to say there would be communications with the planets, realized when the United States put its astronauts on the moon and began to contact Mars and the other planets. The world would become a place where the most distant peoples would exist electronically, as next-door neighbors, sharing their problems, helping or hindering according to our consciousness. Casey stressed that people working together in the same cause could raise the energy and thought to a spiritual level. Some of the physical earth changes mentioned decades ago by Casey could not be changes on a different level, with the positive energy of millions, even billions of earthlings beginning to visualize the Creator as a very real power behind this awesome universe of ours. While incidental quakes and floods are part of the earth's normal evolution, potentially greater changes could come, Casey said, from worldwide political turmoil, depressions, wars, ecological disasters, and climatic changes. subject to the changes he saw in man's energy. God proposeth, man disposeth. Our personal upheavals, said Casey, are not necessarily geological in nature. As to the changes that are coming, these will, as indicated, depend on what individuals and groups do about what they know respecting his will, his purpose with man. So many of the positive changes foreseen by Casey were being reaffirmed almost daily by people massing together, showing a higher consciousness, such as the peaceful convocations of Christians in Washington, dedicating themselves to brotherhood beyond the restraints of their own churches. For didn't Jesus, a recurring emblem of Christianity, say that he was not only the shepherd to his flock, but to those outside the flock? And there were the black women, emulating their men, gathering in a peaceable way, reaffirming their dedication to the dignity and freedom of womanhood under God. The newspapers were full of the one-world consciousness that Casey deemed essential to the existence of a civilized society. We are now allies and friends with nations we once fought. The collapse of communism in Europe, and in China moderation, the European economic community bound with the awareness that we must come together as one planet to heal the ecological, environmental world we call our own. Casey's most provocative predictions were not about earthquakes, but about a new world being born, taking off with this millennium. The changes he saw provided an opportunity to get our priorities in focus. They were not a single event, but an ongoing process. The promise of the new age was a promise of change. The earth changes of the past were experienced, as Casey noted, as an omen of our need for a greater global community. While the usual conflicts of smaller nations for scraps of land persisted, there was a worldwide trend, as Casey saw, toward diverse people working together. The United Nations adopted standards covering economic regulations, nuclear energy, human rights, pollution controls, customs procedures, even space law. Moving to one world society, read a current newspaper headline. Moving slowly, to be sure, with the usual flare-ups in the Middle East, Ireland, the Balkans, Bosnia, with incursions in Africa. But, as Casey stressed, the one world, one fate consciousness was growing. Even the most xenophobic or closed-off peoples were aware they could no longer avoid disaster by shutting down their physical and emotional borders. We are all in the same pot together, and had better tolerate, if not like, each other. While catching on to the reality of a creator who wasn't purely a fancy of man, but a force to be reckoned with in every level of our lives. Chapter 7. The Atlanteans. Just as he saw a communist Russia lifting the Iron Curtain and joining the family of nations, Casey saw the Atlanteans returning to solid Earth to become a friendly force in world affairs by the time the millennium rolls around. Casey knew little about Atlantis early in the 20th century. His conscious mind was very much occupied with his family and friends, in his study groups in the Virginia Beach Tidewater area, which he pronounced the safest place in the country. As the millennium drew closer, visions of Atlantis began to flow through him. He saw a struggle for control of a vast and powerful empire between two bitterly warring factions, the self-indulgent, race-proud, sensuous sons of Belial, and the more spiritual sons of the Law of One. It was a struggle increasingly bitter with the centuries, each side vying to win mastery of the Earth with lethal weapons stemming out of advanced technologies dealing with atomic energy and powerful solar rays. Casey visualized it all in a few stark words, describing an end to a civilization that was far advanced to ours, technologically, whose weapons of destruction exceeded ours, even to the atom and hydrogen bombs. These forces, Casey said, were not only the rays from the sun, set by the facets of the firestones as crystallized from the heat from within the elements of the earth itself, but were as the combination of these. The use of these influences by the sons of Belial brought them the first of the upheavals, by the turning of the etheric rays from the sun, as used by the sons of the law of one for the conveniences as for light, heat, and electrical combinations, into the facet for the activities of same that produced volcanic upheavals of such widespread proportions that it caused the separating of the land into separate islands, 5 in number. And thus the lost continent became the continent of lost souls. Casey had never heard of Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, who was the first to write about a lost continent, presumably destroyed, with its remains submerged in the Atlantic. Not that Casey had ever read about Atlantis. He was too busy with his Bible, which he read every day, and the metaphysical readings he gave in his sleep. His first reading on Atlantis was as much of a surprise as his first reading on reincarnation, shocking to a fundamentalist Baptist who taught Sunday school in a Presbyterian church. He was in a quandary. With his wife, Gertrude, he thumbed through the New Testament. He found a passage where the apostles asked Jesus if he was the prophet Elijah reborn. Jesus replied this was John the Baptist, saying they had taken John's life as they would his. Casey's interest in reincarnation was quickened when he saw something that hadn't struck him earlier in the Bible. Paul, saying that if one man was resurrected, all were. The Atlantis visions began to take on new significance. They poured out of his subconscious mind. He saw hundreds of Atlanteans returning to a planet they had fled thousands of years ago, ready now for a new life, in a millennium with storied memories and high expectations. The early Casey readings on Atlantis revealed a highly technical culture that deteriorated because of the people's rampant greed and lust for power, turning them from the protection of the Creator they knew as the law of one. They became victims of their own self-indulgence, and Casey saw the danger of man repeating the Atlantis disaster. The geologists and archaeologists ridiculed Casey's Atlantis, just as they had sneered at the existence of ancient Troy as an old wives' tale. But a solid-thinking international businessman, Heinrich Schliemann, hardly a scientist, dug up the remains of a fabled civilization out of Homer's stories of the Trojan-Greek Wars, the Iliad, and the Odyssey, and followed the trail of the ancient poet to the buried city, locating not only one, but 7 Troys. With the millennium approaching, numbers of people were heeding the renowned mystic who had gone where the scientists feared to tread. Yet Atlantis is still very much a mystery. From fossil remains, from layers of earth crust, we know the earth goes back millions of years. And yet we have little insight into what happened only yesterday, geologically. Had some cataclysm destroying much of humanity destroyed the records of that humanity? Which, Casey said, were preserved in the sacred tombs of the pyramids, in the ancient land of Egypt, where so many of the Atlanteans, according to Plato, sought a new life. Others turned up in Asia Minor and Latin America, with many city names similar to those in the eastern Mediterranean, already named when the first explorers came from Spain. The Casey readings state that if a geological survey were made along the Gulf Stream near the Bahamian Islands of Bimini, concrete evidence of artifacts would be found, establishing rudiments of the lost continent. Along with the debris of sunken barges and trucks, searchers have located marble pillars and hexagon pavements without getting to the ocean depths, Casey advised. He saw remnants of Atlantis rising before the millennium. Dredging the channel of Bimini Bay recently, researchers did locate in shallow water some freshwater mangrove peat about 9,000 years old, signifying the land was above water at that time for the mangrove trees to flourish, indicating this was then a habitable land, which Casey saw as a remnant of the lost continent. It was a very real Atlantis that Casey visioned. contemplating the destruction that took place in three distinct periods, he warned all this could happen again unless man considered the lessons of the past. Nevertheless, he foresaw a heightening consciousness of these perils, with a new flow of spirituality nourished by the Atlanteans reborn in the new Aquarian age. Casey's 14,000 psychic readings that some 700 of his subjects had incarnations in Atlantis, many of them bringing memories of the past into their new lives, along with the burnished skills and knowledge of a superior technology. Many recounted lives during the three periods of geological change in Atlantis, 50,000 BC, 28,000 BC, and 10,000 BC. They brought their history with them, describing the angry rumbles of earthquakes and volcanoes that gave warnings of the breakup of the land, enabling them, Casey said, to escape to the accessible Mediterranean area. Many settled in Egypt, others drifting to the islands of the Caribbean and the surrounding mainland, where in time they revealed an uncanny knowledge of physics, chemistry, and electronics. One boy was given a reading by Casey when he was only 8, because his parents were struck by his using an unknown variant of gunpowder to make his own fireworks. They were confused by Casey mentioning a technical background in Atlantis, thinking he might be referring to Atlanta and Georgia Tech. As the boy went into junior high and then high school, he shone in chemistry and physics. His academic achievements in other areas were desultory. The parents were nevertheless skeptical when Casey elaborated on the future of this 8-year-old in the electronics field. He became an electrical engineer, a Casey follow-up revealed, developing electronic installations that helped turn the tide for the Allies in the North African fighting World War II. He was so quick to grasp the various technologies that he was given the opportunity in the middle of the war to work on the atom bomb. He muddled over this for some time, his consciousness pricked by hazy recollections of the distant past when he was involved with the explosive forces that brought about the destruction of his former homeland. His Casey reading was something of a guide, hazily recalling its destructive pattern in a past life when he worked with atomic energy. He decided he didn't want to renew the experience. He fought off the pressure to do the atomic work some thought best for the country. Ironically, later in the war, he was dispatched to the Atlantean area off Florida, where Casey said he once lived. He had no feeling of nostalgia. There was a warning in the Casey reading that he could be a constructive or destructive influence. Eventually, he chose the path that would give him a more serene but prosaic life, giving him the love of a caring woman. He was a model husband and father. What doubts he may have had were dispelled by his joy in producing a family with love and goodwill in their hearts. They thanked the Lord for the life given them, having avoided the horrors of a parent producing a bomb that leveled two cities. Did he ever think back on Atlantis? Occasionally. He recalled having something to do with the molding of a firestone, by which atomic-like energy was created as the activity of the stone, as Casey noted, was received from the sun's rays. These then were impelled by the contraction of the rays from the stone centered in the middle of the power station, or powerhouse, as would be termed in the present. These, not intentionally, were tuned too high, and brought the second period of destructive forces to the Atlanteans, breaking up the land into isles when further destructive forces were brought in the land by the setting up in various parts of the land that which was to produce the powers in many forms destructive to the cities, the towns, the countries surrounding same. Casey had gone on with the stone. As to describing the construction of the stone, we find it was a large cylindrical glass cut with facets in such a manner that the capstone on top of same made for the centralizing of a force sufficient to erase any object or center. And this, the boy grown into a man, knew was something the Lord would not be pleased with. Children with Atlantean backgrounds were uniformly advanced beyond their age. Some of the young women were of rare beauty. The Atlanteans were versed in health and beauty potions, exercise routines, and meditation under the auspices of the Law of One, with entrancing visions of the body beautiful. In dealing with the transition from one life experience to another, Casey noted that something of the spirit invariably remained to shape the inclinations and aspect of the currently incarnated person. Elder statesman Benjamin Franklin said of himself that he would come back like a book with a new cover, his age-old yearnings dotting the new pages. There were many surprises in these Casey readings touching on Atlantis. One mother from a wealthy family, concerned about her daughter, consulted Casey with her equally concerned husband. Little did they know that they were to get a tour of Atlantis, with Egypt and the pyramids thrown in. They had heard stories of Casey making the incurably sick well, advising people in the making of millions, telling authors how to write bestsellers. But they were only stories. The mother needed more, for her daughter's sake. The daughter, Ginny, was precocious and pretty. Casey described her to a T, as the parents marveled, and then pictured her as he saw her in Atlantis, bright, impulsive, beautiful. Overactive in the physical and mental, one who in her early development could converse as well as individuals twice her age on the construction of automobiles, gas engines, having knowledge of fumigations for homes and drainages for the better protection of health. She had known lives in Egypt and the Palestine land during those periods when the Master had walked the earth. The advanced life, the gentility and harmony of the teenager was attributed to an experience as the child blessed by the Master when he saith, "Suffer little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of heaven." The parents were looking at each other, bewildered, yet pleased. Their daughter, blessed by Jesus. What could be better? Casey reflected on his own remarks. When a soul, then, has been blessed by him, how may it ever wholly wander from that blessing as given by life itself? How when he, Christ, has promised in thine own experience that ye are to fill a purpose in the life of others. If ye will wholly trust in him, then he and ye will not fail. Before that, Casey went on, the entity was in the land now known as the Atlantean, during those periods when destructive forces were imminent through the falling away of the people and the uprisings of the sons of Belial. She was one of those believing in the Law of One, the Lord, using forces that inadvertently brought bodily instruction, accounting for the teenager's facility with engines and other mechanical devices, yet rejecting the activities of those rebellious to the Law of One, finding those interests in things that have become a portion of the soul activity. These were ideals, he said, still lingering in the subconscious of this idealistic and spiritual teenager about whom the mother was so concerned. There were the usual queries as Casey opened his eyes and smiled. What, asked the mother, is the best way for her mother to handle the conditions that arise in her daughter's life? Most by example, that there is an ideal, and that ideal must be in the spiritual life. That judgments in the moral, the commercial, the material, the mental, may be judged by the one standard set by him who blessed thy daughter in that far land. The mother was also concerned with the physical, her daughter's growth. The girl was already as tall as her mother. Is she growing too fast, and is there any way to keep her from being too tall? Awakened, Casey had no trouble with this. It's the normal, natural development. Let there be sufficient of the correct exercising of the body to keep a normal balance in its development, with a systematic purposefulness. As the mother persisted, the author wondered how she would have felt had the daughter been too short. How, she asked, can one keep from being sensitive about being too tall? Casey answered with equanimity, understanding a mother's concern about an impressionable daughter. Know that what has been builded by self is the expression of that which is best for what the soul has to do in this sojourn. This should, with this knowledge, remove all sensitivity, knowing that what is that which may be used for his glorification in the earth. The mother understood the man she was questioning drew his power from the universal intelligence. She pursued her questioning. Please give any advice to the mother that will assist in making for the best development of this entity. Casey's response was surprising. Let a portion of the dress, either external or that close to the body, have something of blue. Keep not as a charm, but as the influences that may bring the greater force about the body. The moonstone or the bloodstone as the ornaments about the body. But those also to be found, that are akin to these, in the turquoise blue and the pigeon blood ruby. He paused a moment. As to advice to those that are responsible for the soul's environment, first know that not as a duty, but as an opportunity has this soul been in thine own environment, not for self alone, but for the development of the soul that is in thine keeping, that this soul may bring to others much that will remind them oft that he gave. Of such is the kingdom of heaven. He paused again, as if considering the wonders of birth entailed in a new soul, imbued with love, coming into being, needing all the love that could be mustered to navigate the rough and uncertain waters. Casey spoke of soulmates, young men and women in the halcyon days of Atlantis. Like so many in the present, when the first bonding didn't succeed, they tried and tried again. Georgia, twice wed in the distant past, as Casey saw, was a junior executive this time around, pretty, much sought after, but confused whether she should stay on her job or get married. Get married, Casey told her, but be sure, for three times was the charm. Casey rarely acted as a marriage broker, but Georgia was compliant. He advised her to think back on how her soulmate relationship had failed. Too much attention to business. From the appearance as they affect the entity in the present, and the indications as to the abilities of the entity in many fields of service, especially in being of assistance in creating thinking in the minds of associates, we find that home gilding should be the business of the entity, as that time when the disturbances first began. She should look back, said Casey, and see how tending to business rather than her homework may have disrupted an Atlantean relationship she had thought arranged in heaven. Remember the manner of analyzing self, as has been indicated. Look within. Judge or parallel what ye find with thy spiritual ideal. Not as to what you would desire others to be, but as to what ye desire to have others be to thee. That be to them. These are the manners in keeping with the proper material and mental relationships. The business side, as indicated, is of benefit in helpfulness through instructions to many. But the home building should be the work, the life experience. For in this, and through the channels, may the great harmony come. As ye meet thyself in the material plane. Georgia was still doubtful. She had carried a lot of baggage in Atlantis. Would marriage with this young man be advised, or should I wait for another? This, Casey saw, was the same young man she had fretted over in two marriages in previous lives. But he saw a new opportunity in the current experience, as if her subconscious mind had relived it before and recognized, finally, that primary ingredient of life, a little thing called love. There should be the answer from within as to the purposes, the desires, said Casey. If the purposes of each act as a helpfulness one to another. Well, if they do not, look for another, and unto yourself. For this, then, would not be her soulmate. As he said so often, it should be the heart that controls the mind. Still doubtful, she went on to the failed marriage in Atlantis. What were the hurtful associations with my divorced husband, and why did these things turn out as they did? Casey replied, in that experience, when ye were led so far astray in Atlantis, and how could it have been any other way in the present? For the husband was the one who led the self astray in that experience. Again, there were the meetings in the experience just before this, in Egypt. And these were not over-helpful then, for they brought many disturbing conditions. She was still groping, still looking into herself, as Casey had suggested. What, she asked, were the lessons for me to learn in Atlantis? That the spiritual things are to have their spiritual values, and the material things their material values. She looked at him doubtfully for a moment, then, sighing, said as if testing him, for it wasn't very often that a young woman is told she shared two different lives with the same young man and was contemplating a third. Her eyes fell on the sleeping Casey. It had been a long session, and she was tired. But she had to be sure. Casey had been so kind, so reassuring, so patient, that she felt the least bit guilty as she asked, "Please give me the true local time of my present physical birth." Casey didn't hesitate. This, as we find, was on the 18th at 2:33 p.m. She smiled. It was all right now. There was no doubt. She knew what she had to do. What a millennium it would be. Chapter 8. Verna Comes Back. She remembers Atlantis as though it was only yesterday. She remembers the doctors and the chemists, the teachers and their students, the libraries and the museums. There were others, but these played the most vital role in her life. The leaders, the men who rules over the people, lived in great castles and cared not about the people. She and her boyfriends were of the working class and spent their free hours in the libraries and the museums, for there was little other diversion as you lived within the law of one, or Belial. If you were of Belial, you were of those who heeded no law but their own desire, and that was the great trouble, selfishness and greed, and the lust for power. The rules were in Belial's hands, for they knew no power greater than their own, and feared what they did not know. This god worshipped by those who lived within and for the law of one. So few listened, for they found mere words fruitless. When they were warned of the one's wrath, they laughed and drank of the grape and feasted on the leanest part of the unicorn, whom they sacrificed to their gods, the gods of licentiousness and greed, foregoing the commandments so long ago forgotten, telling the people to love one another, or they would be lost, a lost continent, to which they could never return, for there would be nothing. Nothing, not even a flag in the soil where their homes and workplaces, their libraries and schools had once flourished under the law of one. This is the land, Verna remembered. She remembered the good and the bad, for Atlantis had not always been corrupt. But like the land she had found refuge in, it had at one time loved the Creator, whose creation they were. And then, when they grew fat and foolish with power, they forgot who had made them great, until he turned away and it was too late. The planets no longer moved at their bidding, as when they listened to the law of one. For some, it was the end. But Verna had always remembered from whence she came, and the Lord remembered. He always remembered, just as he would remember his only begotten son as the millennium rolled around again. Verna liked it where she was. She had always devoured books where she was, and now she was a librarian in a small but friendly town outside the city of Chicago, with its tall buildings and taller ambitions, its people so often too busy to stop and help a little old lady across the street. Something forgotten, too, by the people who no longer lived with the law of one. But Verna remembered. For like President Harry Truman, one of her heroes, she remembered that those who forgot history would have to repeat it. She didn't mind. She had always loved her fellow creatures. And now that she found herself on the Earth planet, she had become interested in Edgar Cayce, the seer who was so much like the one who comforted so many when he served the Creator and his fellow man in serving the Law of One. She had written some of her story. It was in a modest magazine given over to spiritual matters, and in one page she was able to express what lessons she had learned in the fall of her former land, Atlantis. Not so distant as the Lord counts time and space. She addressed herself to what had gone amiss in that other place, now only a dream in so many hearts, and what she feared might be repeated again in the land she had learned to love as she had the other so long ago. Being well-read and well-schooled and sensitive to change, she had seen the warning signs where others older and more powerful than she had been blinded by an overabundance of good fortune. But it was never too late. Even as the ship was leaving the dock and the planes were poised for the takeoff, she saw the human frailties, the indifference to others and lack of gratitude to the Lord for the gift of life, for which there was no greater gift. One thought kept running through her mind as she picked out books for the book lovers who came into her chambers, and that was saving the world. Yes, she, Verna, not yet 30, unwed, but full of love for her brothers and sisters everywhere, wanting to spread that love, especially on learning from the new prophet of these times that the Son of Man would be making his presence felt in a world waiting for the millennium, not knowing what it would bring. She prayed this would be the world she would find. There is time for a worldwide healing to occur. We have it in our power to prevent destruction from taking place. These words had come to her in the night. Many people, remembering that past, felt it was already too late to even try. But Verna disagreed. It was never too late to get to know your God. Every time I wake up in the morning and hear a bird singing, and every time I look into a beautiful blue sky, I feel hope in my heart. In spite of all our problems and suffering, it is still a beautiful world. She believed in the power of prayer, for she felt that little could be accomplished without it. She had read something about Atlanteans like herself moving off to Egypt after their land was destroyed by the crumbling of the earth and the wrath of the seas. She had read, too, all she could about Egypt and its connection with her homeland. She was intrigued by the pyramids, for she felt, despite their stony silence, that they were old enough and wise enough to harbor the secrets of the ancient past. Like so many, she thought the pyramids had a message not only for God's children, but also for the godless. She saw the tombs of the past as talismans of that past and symbols of the future. Not only are they recognized as holy by the ancient Egyptians, the pyramids assuming the shape of the human body in meditation, legs crisscrossed, back straight, arms resting loosely on knees. Meditation, prayer, joining together the three sides, the physical, the spiritual, and the pulsating earth, each possessing the power to influence the others. The pyramids, grim and forbidding, had a greater purpose than housing the mysteries of the past. Verna knew from Atlantis, as young as she was, that our lives belong to the present and future. The past did its part in connecting us to what lies ahead. She used symbols of the past to help not only herself but others sharing this life experience. For none of us, she knew, lived alone on an earth that was what we made of it with the approval of the Lord. She had read what a great American president had said in the midst of a struggle to preserve the Union. The precise words escaped her, but not the essence. Without the Lord, he said, we are nothing. The Union had been saved, its leader going on, his work done.